It's time for an anatomy lesson on Sunday Extra Now, but not human anatomy, the anatomy of artificial intelligence. We're already living in a very AI world, whether it's talking to Siri on our phones or Amazon Alexa at home, the voice-activated, all-knowing, all-listening Amazon Echo product. AI is making many things more convenient, but our next guest says each small convenience requires a vast planetary network fueled by the extraction of non-renewable materials, labour and data, and that AI algorithms are often laden with biased social assumptions. Professor Kate Crawford is co-founder of the AI Now Institute at New York University, and she's returning home to present the annual Wallace Wirth Lecture at the University of New South Wales tomorrow. I spoke to her shortly before she left for Australia.
When most people hear the term artificial intelligence, they might think of abstract code, or they might think of large-scale data, or they might even think of things like the superintelligence or giant killer robots. But of course, artificial intelligence has now become this extremely prosaic everyday thing that's in our phones, it's in our laptops, it's in the back end of multiple systems that we touch every day. And one of the things that I think is really interesting in the study of artificial intelligence, which I've been doing for over 15 years now, is to actually think much more broadly about what AI really is. And certainly what I try to do is look at these sort of broader ways in which artificial intelligence is constructed. So rather than just thinking about it as code and algorithms, that we could start to look at the industry behind it, the social practices of making artificial intelligence, but also the planetary infrastructures that are required to really make AI function at scale. And then ultimately to start thinking about what are the real costs of producing artificial intelligence at an environmental level, in terms of the labor that goes into actually making it work, all the way through to the sorts of extractive data practices that are required to actually drive contemporary AI.
And this has been the focus of one of your pieces of work, which has got a lot of attention, the anatomy of an AI system. You're obviously taking a broader approach to AI. Can you kind of chart the edges of how broad your anatomy of an AI system is and what sort of things it includes?
This all started a few years ago, actually, when we were looking at how does voice-enabled AI really work. So you'll probably encounter voice-enabled AI if you speak to Siri or Alexa or Cortana or any number of those AI agents that almost always have female names, you might notice. We could go into that another time. But one of the things that I was really interested in was, how do these things work? What's the back end look like? How do they actually function? But rather than just looking at the code, which I started with and doesn't really tell you that much, I teamed up with this fantastic visual designer called Vladan Jola, who's a professor in Serbia, to actually map the entire life cycle of a single Amazon Echo. So we went all the way through the supply chains from the minerals that are actually used to make the devices and through the smelting and the manufacturing and the container shipping, all the way into the data processes in Amazon's own servers where they actually train their voice AI models. And of course, they do that by listening to everybody's voices through those devices and then training their system to become more and more sensitive to understand language and context and give you the right answers. And then all the way through to the end of life of these devices, which of course is in giant e-waste tips in Ghana and Pakistan. So this took us a couple of years, and it was a really difficult process, I'll be honest, just trying to open up not just the black boxes of the code and AI and how we track voice AI systems, but the black boxes of the mining system and how that sector is incredibly secretive. And of course, there are a whole lot of problems in terms of conflict minerals and how you can actually trace these supply chains back to their sources. So we really discovered black boxes on top of black boxes, and it was something that we decided had to be told in terms of the full life cycle of AI from birth to life to death. And we did this as a large-scale essay, which came out as a newspaper, but also as a massive wall-sized visualization so that you can see and trace all of the paths that are taken to actually make a single Amazon Echo actually work. So when you ask the question of, like, you know, how deep did you go? I think we went pretty deep.
Pretty broad, absolutely. Yeah.
But we certainly learned that artificial intelligence is a lot more than people think it is, and a lot of the true costs are very well hidden from us.
Across the breadth of the things that you focus on, human labour is a part of that, and that, I gather, encompasses not just the people who are involved in the manufacture of products like an Amazon Echo, but also us, the user, the purchaser. I wouldn't think of a customer as a form of human labour, but why should I?
It's really interesting, actually, when you start to think of the many ways in which you are actually an unpaid worker for large tech companies. I'm not sure if you've ever had that experience of trying to go to a website and suddenly you get what's called a Google CAPTCHA, where it says, oh, please tell us how many of these signs are actually street signs, and you have to click the boxes before you can actually
get. Yeah, I feel like I'm going to fail the test to be able to do my Google search every
That's
time.
That's it. It's like, are you actually a robot?
Is that a car or is it a street sign?
That's it. Well, what you're actually doing when you do that is you are training Google's image recognition AI system. So you are actually, in effect, an unpaid worker in that moment. Another thing you might do if you have, say, a Google Home or an Amazon Echo in your home is that all of those interactions, all of those conversations that you have with the device, if you ask it, you know, what's the weather today, or, you know, can you play my favorite song, all of those interactions are being recorded and kept to train enormous voice models that they use in perpetuity to, again, fine-tune their systems. And of course, as we've discovered, many of the companies actually continue to record audio even after you've engaged with your assistant. So we've discovered that, in fact, that sort of extractive process of background sound and conversation could be happening in lots more moments than people are actually aware of. So in these ways, you're actually contributing data, you're contributing feedback, and you're, in many ways, really being the laborers that are fine-tuning those systems. Now, while we might be the unpaid laborers, there are people who are very low-paid workers, and these are really the click workers who are there tuning the systems by more directly giving feedback. And of course, we've had some extraordinary exposés of click workers in India and in rural America from academics like Mary Gray and Sid Suri. And that's certainly something that we also explored for this project. The other thing that I did was actually go inside Amazon fulfillment warehouses, as they're called, which are the places where, you know, all of the things that we order for, you know, two-day delivery get boxed up and shipped out to us. And going into these enormous buildings, which are the size of like multiple football fields, and seeing this kind of ballet of robots and human workers in these quite, I would say, harsh conditions, was another thing that really informed this project. And we then went back into the patent archives to see the various patents that Amazon has tried to get to try and create different sorts of robotic human workforces. In fact, one of the things we found was that Amazon had patented a giant cage that they wanted to put workers inside so that while they're working in these fulfillment factories, they wouldn't be bumping into the robots and creating more injuries and more expensive, you know, robotic disasters.
Sounds so like that one might need to go to the HR department first before they roll that one out.
Exactly. Yeah, that one wasn't very popular, funnily enough. So really thinking about all of these different types of labour was something that was really important to us for this project.
Now, you've mentioned the huge amount of data that we're all contributing to artificial intelligence and the almighty algorithms, but there is obviously a lot of focus now on the way in which algorithms are prone to bias. And I'm interested in a phrase that you used, the propagation of error that can kind of be built into artificial intelligence. Can you tell us a little bit about what you've discovered on that front?
I've been studying questions around algorithmic bias for almost a decade now. And one of the things that I've been doing in the last few years is opening up the so-called training data sets that are used. These are the enormous databases that are used for things like teaching AI systems to see if it's a computer vision system or to understand language if it's a natural language processing system. In many cases, they've just been harvested off the internet. If you've ever used Flickr and put up some family photos or pictures of yourself at your graduation, it's probably being used to train an AI system right now. And so no one really really looks at these images and these collections very closely. When I started to do that, I noticed some really troubling features, which is that in many cases, they use terms which are either deeply offensive, so racist or misogynist terms, or terms that are just nonsensical or non-visual. For example, a very famous, probably the most famous training set for object recognition and artificial intelligence, which is called ImageNet. It was made by Stanford in 2009. I recently did a project where we studied what was inside this with the artist Trevor Paglen. And what we found was that, you know, there were categories for things like a colorblind person, for a bad person, for a kleptomaniac, for an alcoholic. And it just gets worse from there. And these, of course, are just images of people on the internet that have been scraped off things like Google Image Search and then put into these categories. And that's very powerful because these training sets are then used in a whole lot of production systems that we use every day. And it's actually very difficult to trace who's using these data sets and which areas have actually shaped. One of the things we did was trace a few of the systems where this data has gone. And that's the kind of propagation that we're seeing, that once a data set or a particular set of approaches in artificial intelligence becomes a benchmark or a standard, it propagates really quickly through a lot of systems that affect millions of people every day. So that's why we need to have this sort of more investigative approach, I think, to really this sort of substrate of artificial intelligence, these things that we use to train systems to understand the world.
On Sunday Extra, we're speaking with Kate Crawford about artificial intelligence in the lead up to her Wallace Wirth lecture. Kate, we've talked about the problems with artificial intelligence and algorithms, but do we need algorithms and artificial intelligence to fix those problems? Is there a technological fix or a way to train an artificial intelligence to recognize and adjust for the potential for bias?
I mean, it's interesting. This has always been, I think, the focus of so many of the AI institutes around the world, which is that when problems emerge, we just throw more AI at the AI problem and we will somehow make it better. This was actually one of the inspirations 4 years ago when myself and Meredith Whitaker, a colleague who had been working at Google for 13 years, to actually create an institute that would focus on the social and political implications of artificial intelligence. Because in our view, you simply cannot have this tech-first solutionism when it comes to looking at these issues. Because, of course, artificial intelligence reflects much broader social and structural issues. If you're just ingesting a whole lot of data off the internet, you're also ingesting all of those biases, all of those histories, all of those particular quirks of who was doing what, when, and how. So in many ways, we actually need a much more refined set of social analytic approaches to how artificial intelligence works. But then I think there could be some really interesting things we could do. Let me give you an example. You might have read recently that Amazon tried to create a resume scanning AI system. So basically they have so many people who try to get jobs at Amazon that they wanted to create a system that could flag a CV and say, hey, you know, this is somebody that you should interview. And they trialed the system for 2 years before they realized that it had this one significant flaw, which was that it always downvoted any women applicants. And they looked at this and they thought, wow, even if you had the word woman on your CV, like say you're the coach of a women's soccer team, then your resume would go to the bottom of the pile. So when you start looking at this, what it's actually doing is it's acting like a diagnostic. The reason why it had this problem, of course, is that the AI system had been trained on all of the former successful applicants to get jobs in Amazon's technical workforce. And I'm sure you can have a guess about what the gender balance
is. So it's perpetuating the existing state of play rather than potentially changing it.
Precisely. I mean, if your technical workforce is over 80% male and they're the resumes that you've got in the pile, then obviously you've skewed a system to actually preference those sorts of candidates. So in a weird way, this is actually an interesting story to me from the perspective of saying this system was acting like a diagnostic tool. It was actually saying, hey, you've got a problem with the way that you're currently accepting workers and actually sorting resumes because you're really preferencing these sorts of candidates. So if we think about that as a kind of almost like a diagnostic tool, AI systems are really good at bringing out and highlighting forms of bias in the underlying data that you have.
Do you get the sense, Kate, that the tech community is actually engaging with these issues and recognizing that it might that the answer might not be in the code, or is there a real culture problem internally that I imagine you're trying to counteract?
Well, I mean, certainly when I first started publishing academic articles about bias and AI about 8 years ago, it was a bit of a heresy. I mean, the wisdom back then was more data is better, and the more data you have, the less bias you have. But certainly what we've seen in the last couple of years, because there have been so many examples, you know, for every single tech company, there's been about 50 stories about biased systems. At this point, the technical field is extremely aware of the fact that this is a problem. But I think right now we're starting to have a bit of a renaissance. I mean, certainly after we created the AI Now Institute at NYU a few years ago, we've now seen an explosion of centers and research institutes that are starting to look at these questions. These new institutes, almost across the board, are interdisciplinary. So, you know, you have engineers and computer scientists sitting with sociologists, anthropologists, philosophers, media studies academics, science and technology studies academics. I mean, that's a really good mix, and we really need to see more of that, because if these systems are going to be used in our most sensitive social institutions like criminal justice or education or healthcare, we're really going to need to make sure that the people designing those systems are a much wider cross-section of disciplinary perspectives and skills, but hopefully also start to include some of the people who will be most affected by these systems. I think that's what we're going to need to do to make sure that these systems don't actually end up creating unintended forms of harm.
Well, Kate Crawford, it's been a great pleasure having a human conversation with you, and I hope that Siri and Alexa agree. Thank you very much for joining us.
Pleasure to chat with you, Julian.
And Professor Kate Crawford will give the annual Wallace Worth Lecture at the University of New South Wales tomorrow on the anatomy of an AI system.